Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach, and this is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 172. Grierson is back from Cannes. Welcome back, Grierson. You just got back yesterday. We are taping this on Sunday of Memorial Day weekend. You just got back Saturday. Welcome home. Is the country in worse or better shape than it was when you left?
So far, so good. I've only been up for a few hours this beautiful Sunday morning. Happy Memorial Day weekend, everyone. So far, country seems okay. We'll talk more about this later, but at the last day of the festival, I said, you know what, guys? I saw like 11 days worth of movies at Cannes. I didn't see Trump in a single film while I was at Cannes. Wow. It was so... Wow. Nice. I can't even begin to tell you.
I'm actually kind of surprised there has not been like an adult week camp for like a Trump-free zone. That seems like something that like wealthy, well-to-do, probably not busy enough or struggling enough white people. Like it'd be a good like a retreat, right? Like a retreat where you just go away for a week and it's a Trump-free zone. It seems like a very nice place.
Yeah, if people want to give us offers for this great idea that we've come up with, we'll happily sit down and listen to some proposals.
This is my fire fest. This is how this is going to go down.
I've only seen the first half of both of those documentaries, so I assume they went well.
They were fine. It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. This is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 172. My name is always, follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. See us on Facebook, I think, and Instagram, definitely, maybe, at Grierson Leach. Go to our website, GriersonLeach.com. Go to GriersonLeach.com/RSVP to see a list of every single movie we've talked about on this air. Podcast. Emails GriersonLeach@gmail.com. GriersonLeach@gmail.com. I'm answering all those emails now. Send them. The opening songs from Dylan Mayer on Cuthbert Avenue, Bandcamp, and SoundCloud's place. Find it. Closing songs, My Friend Mary. New album is Short Songs on Melancholy Longings. Facebook page, My Friend Mary. I know you were in Cannes for a while, Grierson, but do you remember where we get the t-shirt?
Hang on, let me think.
No, God.
Oh, I know. It's cottonbureau.com. By the way, is that really their new album anymore?
No, it's not, but whatever.
It's their most recent. It's their most recent opus.
Yeah, see, the shtick of the, we can just plow on through the t-shirt part. So, mind you, by the way, you can subscribe to us.
Cottonbureau.com, for God's sakes, people. Get bored.
Yes, get bored. Google Play, Stitcher, Overcast, SoundCloud, Spotify, iHeartRadio. But the best way to find every new podcast is to subscribe to us on iTunes and Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, give us a review. 5 stars if you could, Grierson and Leach. And give us, in that review, give us the name of a movie you would like us to discuss, and we will discuss it in our reboot section. We have a packed show this week, Grierson, because we got to talk about Cannes. We got two new movies to talk about, but we still have time for a reboot. So the reboot this week comes to us from, this is, I would say, one of my favorite names, Vlad the Impaler.
Hello, I can't do the accent. Hello. Yeah. I would like to suck your blood. Suggestively.
You just seem like you want your blood sucked. I don't know.
You were kind of implying that you
Vlad the Impaler. I guess he's implying. Anyway.
If I have to come out and tell you I want to suck your blood, then I'm not doing my job properly. Yeah.
Vlad the Impaler from April 10th, 2016, back when humor existed.
I was going to say, poor Vlad.
So much fun. 5 stars, back when fun existed. Grierson Leach has become one of my favorite podcasts. Their camaraderie makes listening to reviews of movies they don't like or I don't like fun, despite those facts. I'd love if y'all took some time to talk about Mad Max, the original 1979 version, a movie I have to say, Grierson, I had never seen. So I'm kind of excited to talk about this movie, Mad Max 1979, directed by George Miller, not to be confused with Andrew Miller, reliever for the team that has completely fallen apart.
Though he got the win yesterday.
Yeah, pitcher wins don't count. Come on, don't pay attention.
But the point is, he didn't blow it. He didn't get a blown save or a loss. So in that case, a win is very important.
Know that I will be producing and editing this podcast while watching the Sunday night game between the Cardinals and the Braves. So if you hear screams just randomly in the background, know the reason why. All right, Grierson. So I want to talk to you first. Before we get into the movies we have to discuss, I want to talk to you about the Cannes Film Festival. Now, I'm always wary of talking too much about the Cannes Film Festival because inevitably you've seen these movies and I haven't, and I will eventually see them. So I don't want you to tell me too much about them. So I have three questions. You just answer them. And if you feel like you need to editorialize and bring things in that are extraneous to my questions, feel free. Just know we have three more movies to talk about after this. Keep that in mind.
We get windy. We worry about being condensed around.
Yeah, you get windy. There. I don't, but you get a little windy.
Right.
All right. So first off,
I wasn't paying attention from the whole 5 minutes of the intro you do.
That's not okay. 5 minutes. I kept it tight today. So okay. So the first question for you. I have three questions. The first question for you is simple, a little basic, obvious question. What was the best movie you saw at Cannes?
The best film I saw at Cannes this year was a movie that we talked about beforehand, The Lighthouse, Robert Eggers' follow-up film from he did The Witch, was his first film.
Mm-hmm. I remember The Witch.
What noise was that you were doing?
That was me going, mm-hmm, I remember The Witch, because I didn't like The Witch. You know what?
You hated The Witch.
You know who else didn't like The Witch? America. America did not like The Witch. I know some critics like The Witch, and film festival people like The Witch, but right. America did not like The Witch. You're telling me this is better than The Witch?
I think it's comparable to which is a very different type of movie in certain ways. In other ways, it very much feels like a natural progression of Robert Eggers made with his first film. And when we talked about it before I went to Cannes, I said I really didn't know anything about it because nobody really did. It was it's about two lighthouse keepers in black and white played by Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe, and that's all anybody knew about going into it, and that's all I think people should know going into it.
Okay. Fair enough. I don't want to ask any more questions. I'm a little disappointed by that answer, to be honest with you, but maybe this one's better.
What if I had said Deerskin, Will, the movie that you were very unhappy about that was playing it at Cannes?
But then I would have just, I mean, I don't take that guy, I don't take that guy seriously. That movie's worse than The Witch. I'll agree. Rubber is worse than The Witch. I will die there. I'm on the record. Yeah. But nevertheless.
It's Jean Dujardin wearing a leather skin jacket. And then
is Deerskin bad? This doesn't count most of my questions.
Deerskin is fun. It is fun. It is funny. It's not okay. Great, but it's actually pretty amusing, I think. We tweeted... from the Grierson Leach account, we retweeted my link of my list of all the films I saw with the links to the reviews and like that. So you can see I saw 33 films, I think. Yeah.
Wow.
Some of them I saw in advance, but 33 films.
How in the world did you have time to party? Okay. That's also not one of my questions. My second question, and I don't
much like Aladdin, you only get three. That's it.
I know. You can't wish for more. I got to trick you. Okay. So question number two.
Yes.
I don't necessarily need your opinion about this movie.
This is, by the way, the bedrock of our friendship.
Yeah, I don't need to hear your thoughts or feelings. Okay, so...
You only need to about this movie, but go ahead.
My second question is, one of the most anticipated movies at the Cannes Film Festival was Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Now, I don't know any plot details of the movie. I don't know anything about it all. I don't, other than the reaction, which seemed to be generally positive, and that there is some debate whether the movie is in fact done, because this is a movie that had to be kind of rushed together a little bit to get together for Cannes. Can you report, put your journalist hat on, is the movie that you saw in Cannes, what is the likelihood that the movie that we see here in America in July is the same movie or a different movie?
It sure felt done when I saw it. I was sort of running around the day of the press conference where he said he might make it longer, which is funny because normally what happens when a film premieres at Cannes, you will hear, oh, well, they might make it a little bit shorter, or they might kind of tweak it a little bit. And that's sort of a well-established Cannes tradition that happens a lot. But it feels like the length of a Tarantino movie, and it feels like it doesn't feel too long, nor does it feel too short. It definitely felt like the movie that he wanted to make. That doesn't mean that he's not going to go back and you know, do a little thing here or there, or make it longer like he said that he might, because as he put it, there was good stuff that he cut out that he may decide to put back in for the US release. It's 2 hours and 40 something minutes though. So I guess it's a question of whether or not Sony will say, like, can we have this not be any longer than it was? But I don't know how much control. I don't know what the contract is in terms of how much Tarantino can dictate what the length of that movie is. But no, while watching it, I did not think, oh, well,
he rushed this. He's got to fix
this program. Without going into specifics, no, I didn't watch it and think, oh, it did not feel like a work in progress. Okay. There was another film in the competition this year that was so down to the wire that it didn't have closing credits because it was that, like, okay, we're done. Just put it in the theater to show it at the festival. This was not that. It had full credits. It felt like a complete film.
Okay, fair enough. And my last question, and then if you want to answer this question and then go into any final thoughts on the film festival, feel free. But my final question, what was it? Is it 3 years, 4 years since your favorite movie at Cannes? I believe your favorite movie for the year, if memory serves correct. Blue is the Warmest Color. Was that 4 years ago?
That was my first Cannes.
Oh, so it's been longer than that. Right.
That was 2013. Yeah.
2013. Yeah. So that was your favorite movie of the year, correct?
Well, it was my favorite at Cannes, but what happened is that also my number two movie ended up lapping it, which was Inside Llewyn Davis.
Right,
they were both the same year. Yeah.
Right, okay. So Blue is the Warmest Color. I also like Blue is the Warmest Color. I think it may have snuck in at 10 on my list, or not. I don't remember exactly. It was 10. It was toward the bottom, or it was an honorable mention, but I thought it was good as well. So Blue is the Warmest Color, big hit at Cannes. Could you say the name of the director for me, please? Abdelatif Kechiche?
I call it Abdelatif Kechiche.
Yeah, that wasn't bad, actually. So I've just been hearing some reports. Because if you remember, after Blue is Warmest Color, which is a really good movie, the actresses kind of talked about how they felt like a little exploited by the director. The director appears to have steered into that curve steered into the skid, I believe is actually the correct terminology on that. In that, and I don't know if you saw this movie or if you can tell me anything about the reaction to this movie. He seemed to have a movie at the festival this year that, according to Kyle Buchanan of the New York Times, was 60%, and this is not an exaggeration, 60% just close-ups of people's butts. Did you see that movie, and can you report, if you did see the movie, can you confirm whether that's true? And if you did not see this movie, can you talk about whether I imagined that tweet storm about this movie?
You did not imagine it, though I did not see the movie. The aforementioned movie that was rushed to the last minute that did not have end credits was the Kechiche film.
Hmm. What's it called?
It's called McTube Part 2 Intermezzo. He actually had a earlier installment of this film, like a part one, that played at the Venice Film Festival in 2017, I want to say. Did not get good reviews there. It's a love story set in the early 1990s. It did not get good reviews at the Venice Film Festival. It did not play in Toronto. It did not play in the U.S. It's almost impossible to find. And when this second installment of this series of films called Intermezzo was announced for Cannes kind of late, there was some concern on my part and other people's part in America of, like, who were going to the festival, like, how can we see it? My favorite anecdote about that is that a colleague of mine said, well, the easiest way to find it in the U.S. Semi-legally is actually on Pornhub, because it's in its entirety on Pornhub. It is no longer available on Pornhub. I checked. But for a while, it was there. So thank you, colleague of mine who told me that. So here's a story about Intermezzo. When it was announced for the Cannes Film Festival, the running time was 4 hours. And there was potentially report that he was going to be getting it down, he's going to be getting to the wire, he's going to be playing near the end of the festival because he was still kind of working on it. When it got released or when it played at Cannes, Intermezzo was actually 3 hours and 25 minutes. He had cut out a whole segment of the film, apparently. I did not see it because I did not see the first installment, and it was near the end of the festival, and I had other things I was kind of working on at that point. So I was waiting for the initial reviews, and oh boy, though initial reviews, you know, I'm a critic for Screen International. One of the things that Screen International is most known for is at the Cannes Film Festival, we do a critics grid where our review, and we go from 0 stars to 4 stars. We give each film in the competition 0 to 4 stars. No half stars, by the way. It's a fun challenge, Will. Very fun challenge. But anyway, we do it. We also have critics in the US, in the UK, in France, in Russia, assign star ratings as well. 2013, Blue is the Warmest Color was the number one, was the top film on our critics grid. This year, Kashish was dead last. Absolutely, people just absolutely hated this movie. And I have talked to several people who have seen the movie, and the butts thing is not an exaggeration. There is a ton of it. Most of the movie, the rumor was that initially all 4 hours of the movie were just set in a disco club. That is not the case. Apparently, it's like 2/3 of the 3-hour and 25-minute is just people at a club with lots of like close shots of butts as people are like bumping and grinding and stuff like that. It is apparently absolutely atrocious. I think it was my friend Boyd, who reviewed it for Hollywood Reporter, talked about like it's not just a hard sit, it's impossible to sit through. And what's funny is that Kashish said that this is the second installment in a 3-part thing. And this is, you know, as because it's the, you know, it's the intermezzo, it's sort of a palate cleanser before the final part. Will the final part ever be made? It's hard to know, because one of the other stories that came out of this year's Cannes is that apparently Kashish was, and this is again apparently, Kashish was trying to get his actors to do things they didn't want to, so he then plied them with liquor to get them to do things that they do in the movie. I'm sure that won't be a problem for anyone.
Boy, this guy really feels like a filmmaker for our time.
Well, it was definitely funny that I we talked about this a little bit. Can this sense of like, oh, this is a guy who is from a now bygone era, and he just missed it, but now that era is indeed bygone. So, you know, the thing I mentioned on my personal blog where I ranked all my films I saw at Cannes, I'm still curious. But again, since I haven't seen the first part, I won't know who these characters are, and apparently you do need to know that a little bit.
You have to at least recognize the butts. You got to recognize the butts.
I don't want to brag. I feel like I can spot a butt pretty well. I don't need that. But apparently, in terms of the character development and all that, I mean, is this going to play in Toronto? Is this going to play anywhere else? Probably not. I mean, every year there is a film in the competition at Cannes that just gets murdered. You know, the Sean Penn movie, The Last Face, the Gus Van Sant movie, Sea of Trees. There's a film that's put into competition that just gets massacred. Intermezzo was that film. And like I said, he was trimming that thing to the last minute. There were no end credits. It was just basically like, last scene, turn on the lights. Everybody's like, oh, can we go home now finally? Yes. By the way, that first screening, that first press screening was at 10 p.m., which is a tough time, I think, to ask people. Even if you are at a dance club, that's a difficult assignment for people. I am not entirely sorry that I missed that.
All right. Any final things you want to say before we start talking about Aladdin?
Well, the thing I would say is that the Palme d'Or winner, the jury prize winner, was Parasite, the Bong Joon-ho film, his first film since he did Okja, which was also premiered at Cannes. You know, you and I talked about Bong Joon-ho because we did the reboot of Memories of Murder several months ago now, and we'll get into it more. I'm almost positive it's going to get a U.S. theatrical release this year. It was also the best reviewed movie. It topped the Screen Critics Jury grid, and also is just sort of the consensus favorite. We'll have more stuff to talk about, but especially in light of what we talked about in terms of not just Memories of Murder, but Bong Joon-ho's career in general, this movie is, I think, a very kind of interesting evolution in terms of that conversation that you and I had about that. But yeah, there were several films I enjoyed. I said my list is there on my site if people are interested in that. In case anybody's wondering, The Lighthouse was actually Director's Fortnight. And Director's Fortnight is a separate thing. It's not part of the official competition, so it could not have won prizes. So people are like, hey, how come it didn't win anything? It's not eligible for those things. That's why it could not win.
All right, Parasite, didn't the jury say it was a unanimous pick?
Yes, Inarritu did say that. Yeah. He also said that he likes being impregnated by cinema. I don't know how many people were paying attention to the opening. the Cannes jury always, at the very beginning of the festival, they come out, they have like a press conference, and they sort of talk about like what they're excited about or, you know, just kind of whatever, because they haven't seen anything yet. And Inarritu sort of talked about the fact that he loves movies, and he loves the theatrical experience. I think that was what it was connected to, because this is now often one of the battlefronts at the Cannes Film Festival, this whole thing about the theatrical experience and the future of the theatrical experience. And he was saying, you know, he loves to be in the theater. He loves to be impregnated by cinema, which was a great way to start the festival, was the idea of him being impregnated by cinema. It was a fun, I mean, not that I hung out with the jury, but it was actually a really good group of people. You had Yorgos Lanthimos, you had Paolo Palikowski, who did Cold War last year. You had Elle Fanning on there. You also had Kelly Reichert, who, of course, I'm a massive mm-hmm. fan of. And what was great is that they always do a big big photo shoot of the whole jury the first day before the festival begins. They're all standing up next to each other, kind of arm in arm. I have seen Kelly Reichert in person. I did not realize how diminutive she was in comparison to everybody else on her jury. She looks so tiny, it's adorable. You could like put her in your pocket, apparently. But yeah, it was a good festival. Not one of my all-time favorites, but there will be several films that are going to be getting released this year, not just Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but some other ones. So we'll be discussing those as the year goes on.
All right. Of course, everyone, make sure to go to timgrayson.blogspot.com and see his list of his rank Cannes movies. I actually have not gone to the page yet because I don't want to know yet. I'm trying to.
I figured you had not. And my last thing, by the way, Bong Joon-ho, first South Korean winner of the Palme d'Or. If they had just done it last year for Lee Chang-dong, he could have been the first. But oh well, that's fine.
Of course, I was reading the paper in North Korea. I actually thought all of the Palme d'Or winners in the past had all been from North Korea. I guess that's not.
Not close.
Not even close.
Not even close.
Because North Korea, they have propaganda. You see how it goes. It's like the way that we're going to look in like 15 years. All right.
15 years. That sounds optimistic.
I'm being nice. I know. I'm being real nice. I'm just giving us time for the darkness to settle in. All right, now it's time to talk about some new movies. Our first new movie is Aladdin.
Oh, great one who summons me, I stand by my oath, loyalty to wishes three.
I'm kidding. Watch this.
Watch out! You done wound me up, you ain't never had a friend like me.
Aladdin is directed and co-written, I like to imagine, like back when he's making Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch, Guy Ritchie saying, you know what I really ultimately want to do is a live action remake of Aladdin. Like that's where all that started. This was the dream project he was working toward.
The long arc of history is bending towards a Will Smith live action Aladdin.
This is always all he always what he always wanted. So this is Aladdin. We all know Aladdin. Original Aladdin came out in 1992, I believe. This one is a live action version. Kind of is what they're doing with Disney these days. They're making live action version of some of their old animated hits. Kind of started with the Jungle Book. The big one coming out this summer is The Lion King. This one is Aladdin. This one stars Mina Massad as the Aladdin, or Prince Ali, as he is known later. Naomi Scott as Princess Jasmine. And, of course, Will Smith as the genie, if you will. Not if you will. That's actually what he is. So, basically...
you have to accept that he is the genie.
He is the genie. He is the genie. So, basically, this is a... it has that kind of weird feel that I think... the basic story is, you know, he's a street urchin, just an urchin living under the street. Out there, he has to steal to survive, but he comes across the princess, though he thinks that she is the handmaiden to the princess, Princess Jasmine, where they have a clear spark, but it turns out that the evil Jafar, played by Naveed, is that right? Who played? No, he's a good guy.
Marwan Kenzari.
Yeah, Naveed's a good guy. Marwan Kenzari is Jafar. And Jafar is trying to take over as the Sultan of the kingdom. Meanwhile, so he makes Aladdin go get a lamp. It turns out that Aladdin ends up rubbing the lamp, and out comes the genie, and he gets three wishes. And that's, you know, we know this story. We know Aladdin, and that's kind of the one weird thing about this. You know, the Jungle Book, which was directed by Jon Favreau, who's also doing The Lion King. One of the things I liked about The Jungle Book, I didn't love The Jungle Book, but one of the things I liked about The Jungle Book was it really felt like there was a reason to make a live action version of this, in the same way that I can actually see where they might be coming with it when it comes to Lion King. It felt like kind of making that animated world more palpable and more quote unquote real was an interesting choice. And there were some interesting, there's actually some kind of cool action scenes in that. And I thought some actually not bad stuff going on in that. The weirdest part about this Aladdin is there's really no logical reason to make this not animated anymore, other than you can make an argument for like representation. I think that's like, there's a good extra textual reason to maybe make a live action version of this. I will say in the actual execution, particularly for the first half hour, it is worth noting that for the first half hour of this movie, I found completely airless and just like, it felt like bad. It had an unmistakable community theater vibe to it. And I was like, uh-oh, this thing is really falling apart. It picks up a little bit. This should probably get us into the Will Smith portion of this. Obviously, Robin Williams as the original genie in Aladdin was the thing that everyone remembers about that movie. It is worth noting when you and I saw Aladdin way back in the 90s. My major takeaway from the movie was, yeah, Robin Williams really brought a ton of life to that thing that might not have been there otherwise. And I like Beauty and the Beast of a lot more. And I feel like a lot of these like Robin Williams riffs aren't going to age well. But like he brought the gusto to a movie that otherwise I didn't find particularly inspiring. I felt that was kind of the case here, particularly for the first half hour. So Will Smith has a lot to carry anyway, let alone trying to do the Robin Williams part from that. I think Will Smith, someone we like very much. I think that when the video came out of him doing Prince Ali, the song, which is a much slower, less like hell's a poppin' version than the Aladdin version, and then they turned out so blue, there was like a worry like, oh no, is this going to be a disaster? I don't think it's a disaster. I think he is fine. It's kind of fun to see Will Smith a little looser than we've actually seen him maybe in his last few movies. I think there's a certain piousness that's kind of crept into his performances. He's a little looser. He has a little bit more fun in this. It still feels weird to see him as a big blue masculine genie. It also feels like they should just go ahead and just make the whole movie animated, because they're, even with all the computer effects they can do, it never feels as light on its feet as an animated film would. That said, when he arrives, it does perk up the movie a little bit. I think then the movie gets a little bit better and kind of finds its footing in the, I think maybe the lesson of the movie. I think Princess Jasmine has a lot more to do in this movie. I think the movie's a little too self-conscious about that, but I still think the message is somewhat appreciated. I think Jafar is really lame, and that really hurts this movie. I don't think this movie is good. But I will say the first half hour is like, this thing is a shipwreck. This thing is a nightmare. It does get better than that, but that's a little bit too far for me to say that it's actually good.
Yeah, I don't like it either. It is strange to watch the movie, being the age that you and I are, and to go, yeah, this is a live action version of the movie I saw. Because this is not dissimilar from the experience of watching the live-action Beauty and the Beast, which is, yeah, this is that movie, but it's live-action now. And it's not bad, but it's sort of kind of, I mean, the answer to the earlier question about why do this is, of course, money, and they're going to make a lot of money. What's funny is like, there's all this concern of like, oh God, this is going to be a train wreck. It's not going to make it. It's going to be a disaster. And I think from the initial reports of the weekend, it's going to do actually quite well. And it's going to, I mean, it may not do as well as, say, Jungle Book or Beauty and the Beast, but it's going to do, no one's getting fired over this, put it that way. And I even remember back in the day when you and I saw this movie together that you liked the original Aladdin more than I did. And my problem with the new Aladdin, beyond the things we've already discussed, is that the things that I didn't think worked in the original are not improved in this new version. And the main problem is people, you know, back then in the early 90s, had to be reminded that Aladdin was not the name of the genie, because Aladdin's actually the main character of the movie, but he is less interesting. And I think that's the same problem here. I like Masoud. I'm not sure how you pronounce his name. And I also like Naomi Scott, who plays Jasmine. But those characters are just not interesting. They're just not very interesting. Their love story is not very interesting. It's a very sort of wrong side of the tracks kind of love story. It's got the other added problem of, is a story about, you know, someone misidentifies somebody else, and there's so like a bunch of confusion. Though the movie's real MVP, Will Smith is good, but Nassim Piorad is really, really great in this, and she's so fun as Jasmine's handmaiden or servant, or I'm not sure what her job title is exactly, but she's really, really fun in this, and she actually brings a lot of life to it. She helps a lot. But the actual story of Aladdin is not super interesting. They add more plot to this version from the original. None of that really helps. Genie has more to do in this version of the movie. I don't think a lot of that helps. But the problem is, it just feels like a very competently done recreation of the animated movie. And that is very much, I feel like, what these movies are trying to do. They don't want to color outside the lines too much. They want to create a new marketable experience that is different than the other one, so that you will spend money again to see something that you have already seen. And this is not the most inspiring way to make cinema, which is, do it like that, but not too different, but not too close. Just kind of get in that kind of middle ground. Alan Menken's songs are still great, and that helps when the song sequences kind of kick in. That, I think those are the strongest stuff in the movie. It's funny because I saw this pre-Cannes, and I saw it before Disney released the Prince Ali sequence. I saw that a lot of people were really ripping on it. I actually think it works pretty well in the movie. I think it's actually pretty fun. I think the choreography in general in the musical sequences work pretty well. Not only does it feel like a faithful live recreation of the movie, it feels like a template for Disney saying, hey, you know, we could put this on Broadway too if we wanted to. I mean, there's also that, like, in terms of like corporate synergy, there's also that feeling of like this being a test case for them then putting it on Broadway. And that's kind of the thought process kind of throughout the movie. I think Will Smith is perfectly fine. He's not as inspired as Ron Williams was in the original, but he's not bad, and he doesn't embarrass himself. One of the things I wrote while I was gone was a piece for Mel magazine. And one of the things I started talking about is like, you know, this is to me Will Smith being America's dad. Like, you know, he was our box office like superstar for such a long time. He was a king of 4th of July blockbusters. And now he's kind of like downshifted into being like you're like goofy uncle or your corny dad or whatever. And that's kind of how he plays the genie. And I prefer him in his sort of younger guise. I think he was more exciting that way. But I have been very fond of Will Smith on film for a very, very long time. And I found myself enjoying the experience of seeing him like this. Though there are times I will say that it feels like he is so he kind of like hams it up in terms of trying to get laughs, where it just sort of seems like it's so broad that it feels not like him, like he's doing an impression of somebody else or something. The movie is like, if you are listening to this and you are taking your kids to this, I think your kids will enjoy it. I think you'll have a fine enough time. I agree with you, Will. I think Jafar is terrible in this, by the way. He is, I think, actually, like, that's a big problem in the movie. It's sort of a shrug of a film. And, you know, it's a, you know, robustly made shrug of a film, but it's kind of hard to get super excited one way or the other about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the main things to credit this movie for is not being a total disaster. Because it sure felt like one. It sure felt like, I gotta tell you, the first half hour is, and I think a lot of it's because, yeah, Aladdin's not interesting, Jasmine's only slightly more. They made her a little bit more interesting for this, but just a little bit. And he's really not interesting at all. I think he's well played. I actually felt like he doesn't really get his rhythm until about halfway through. There's like a goofy dance sequence where he's kind of funny in, and I feel like that kind of won me over in a way that I'd been kind of skeptical of him beforehand. That's kind of fun. Well, you're right. I kind of like this is kind of like, this feels a little like, I don't know, like Tom Hanks playing Walt Disney maybe with Will Smith, like the America's Dad kind of idea. Like, okay, I can kind of do this and whatever. There are times you kind of roll your eyes and I get it. I've seen all the same jokes about the funny Twitter meme of Will Smith rapping over the closing credits of old movies that actually happens in this movie, which is, yeah, maybe not great. But on the whole, again, I feel like Will Smith is pretty good at escaping or at least salvaging his dignity in bloated big movies like this. I think Suicide Squad would be the most recent example. I think he doesn't save his dignity when he's, maybe it's his like a passion project and he's right in the middle of it. I'm thinking of 7 Pounds be the best example on this. Can you tell that we did our Will Smith rankings recently and I have a lot of Will Smith movies on my brain. Yeah. But I would say that like this is a movie where, listen, Will Smith all blue as the genie in a corny kind of hackneyed remake of Aladdin sounds like something that everyone would all line up and be like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. Like kind of like the 7 Pounds thing. He's not that bad. He's not that bad, but he's not good enough to make this worthwhile.
No, I mean, one of the things that I was thinking of is that I don't watch those live musicals that they've been doing on TV the last couple of years that, you know, depending on what I read on Twitter, are either like amazing or amazingly terrible. But, you know, they have kind of a train wrecky, but we're putting on a show kind of vibe to them. And Aladdin is a more successful, professional, polished version of that. But there is that same, I think, nostalgic impulse. And with those types of projects, you tend to have, like, you know, an older veteran star who can just kind of use his or her persona to kind of fill in the gaps of what is otherwise lacking. And that's kind of what Will Smith does in this. In terms of what's new in the movie, I don't remember the original Aladdin super well, but anything that didn't seem to work really well in this, I was like, oh, I bet this is new, and I tended to be kind of right in terms of plot stuff. And also with Jasmine, while I, of course, appreciate the idea that they want to make her more, not just like a pretty princess, they want to give her more sort of agency. While I absolutely respect and appreciate that, it does kind of drive me crazy when how they kind of try to do that in movies like this, where it seems tacked on in a way that feels somewhat cynical and doesn't feel entirely kind of organic to the overall story. Yeah, I mean, the fact that this is not a disaster, I think, is probably music to Disney's ears, because I think they were pretty worried about this for a while. This is not going to do as well as Lion King. Lion King is going to be, I think everybody is sort of placing their bets that that's going to be like the big summer movie. Aladdin is fine in the way that Beauty and the Beast was fine. It's better than Dumbo. I was less high on Jungle Book than a lot of people were. These all are just kind of okay. And I will say this. You know, a lot of people said, good God, these Marvel movies, we're stuck with these movies. They're all kind of the same. But at least they actually try to be somewhat inventive. The one thing I don't like about these Disney live-action movies is they feel like the opposite of inventive. They feel like a way of perpetuating franchises in ways that just makes them feel like, I've heard them described as like, you know, karaoke acts or things like that. It, you know, it is sort of like, hey, it's the movie again, but this time it's live action and you can see people dancing. I mean, the musical stuff of this is fun, but yeah, it's, I'm not surprised it made a ton of money. Great. But it's hard to have much enthusiasm about stuff like this.
All right. What did you give it?
I gave it a C plus.
Oh, I gave it a C. I thought we might have an agreement on this. I'm a little lower on it than you. I feel like this feels like the ultimate Gentleman C movie. It's like, you know what? I really feared you were going to be worse than this. You're not good, but I feared you would be worse than this. So
so many college graduation speeches are like,
I was gonna say, I feel like that summed up almost everyone's reaction to every first date they've ever had with me. Just the idea
that, yeah, you know, I think Nassim's great. I think she is really, really great. I hope that this continues to raise her visibility. She's great. I always enjoy her and stuff. I think she's really fun. That is her, and her scenes with Will Smith bumped it up to a C plus for me.
All right, so that is Aladdin. Now we go to our second new movie of the week, and that movie is Booksmart.
Amy, you've been out for 2 years and you've never kissed a girl.
I really don't know what I'm doing with all that stuff.
I have a secret for you.
I once tried to masturbate with an electric toothbrush, but I got a horrible UTI.
Yeah.
Like, horrible.
I wish that would have been a secret, but you've mentioned it many, many times.
Booksmart is the feature directorial debut of actress Olivia Wilde. And it stars Beanie Feldstein, who you probably know by this point is Jonah Hill's younger sister, and Caitlin Dever. They play Amy and Molly. They are two high school students. Beanie is Molly. Caitlin Dever is Amy. Molly is her class valedictorian. Amy is her best friend. They're getting ready to graduate. They're going to both go off to really great colleges. They're both super smart, kind of nerdy, and they've spent their entirety of their lives not partying, not getting distracted from their schoolwork because they wanted to make something of themselves, get into good schools, have good jobs, the whole thing. The funniest joke in Booksmart happens relatively early on, and it's kind of part of the premise of it, which is that they find out that after spending this entirety of their lives staying away from parties and not having fun and doing all that, that a lot of their classmates that they hate, who are big partiers, are in fact also going to good schools because they've done a lot of like extracurricular stuff to get them into good colleges. This whole movie exists before the whole cheating scandal happened. I can't even imagine what I saw this movie months ago. I can't even imagine what it's like to watch this movie now. But that joke, I think, is so great in this movie because it provokes Molly to say, you know what, we spent our entire lives not having fun, and these people ended up going to good schools too. Fuck it. We're going to go to a really great, like, raging party before we graduate so we can finally have the experience because we deprived ourselves so we could get this great reward. It doesn't even matter because these other people got the same reward. We're going to have a fun time. So hijinks ensue from there. It's impossible to talk about Booksmart without talking about Superbad, which was a somewhat similar concept. I guess you also could say maybe something like American Pie, but to me, Superbad is more of the obvious connection. Why? Because her older brother, Jonah Hill, was in that movie, but also it was about two guys who were not the coolest in their high school, who were getting ready to graduate, who, like the characters in Booksmart, are going their separate ways after high school. This movie was a premiere at South by Southwest. Got a huge response. People absolutely went crazy for it, absolutely loved it. I saw it maybe a week after South by Southwest here in Los Angeles. And, you know, I think a lot of people sort of thought this was going to be a big sort of indie hit. It's just doing okay this weekend at the box office, which should not dissuade you if you're interested in seeing Booksmart. I have to say that I think this movie is good, and I think this movie is funny. I don't think it's quite as great as a lot of critics do. And I'll get into that in 1 second. The thing that is great about the movie is its 2 stars. From the evidence presented in Booksmart, I would happily see Caitlin Dever and Beanie Feldstein be in anything together, because they are so much fun. And specifically what I think they do really well is they create a sense of a shared friend language that nobody else understands, but they understand completely. Anybody who listens to this here podcast on a weekly basis will sometimes hear me and Will reference jokes from so many years ago. And I was actually thinking about this earlier today, Will, where it's like, people are like, what the hell are they talking about? This means nothing to me. Well, there is a shared language that old friends have, and I think Amy and Molly have that. And I think the Booksmart understands that in a really great, lovely way. It's just fun to hang out with these two people as they go on their misadventures. What I think keeps the movie from being as great as a lot of people think it is for me is I think that ultimately the story, the trajectory of what they are doing on their one crazy night blowout party evening thing is somewhat familiar. We have seen these types of things happen before, and even some of the emotional arc that the two characters go through is not dissimilar from things we have seen from other kind of teen high school comedies. The fact that it's two women as opposed to two dudes, as it usually is in these types of movies, is not unimportant. It is not it's sort of a meaningful thing in terms of the importance of this movie. I don't want to discount that. But at the same time, I feel like I have seen this kind of story before. So what really kind of saves it is the two of them. And also, I would say that, you know, Olivia Wilde, we all, you know, mostly know her as an actress, though she's directed some music videos. She directed a short film called Free Hugs that she did for, I think, a promotion for Revlon about maybe 8 or 9 years ago. And if you see Free Hugs, it's actually available online on YouTube. What connects Free Hugs to Booksmart is that she has an affection for people. It really kind of comes through. There's a real kind of sunniness, a real warmth to Booksmart, which is also really nice. This is not an overly mean high school comedy. It's not that kind of thing. It's actually kind of warm and kind of happy. Some of the side characters, I think, are a little too broad. Some side characters don't get enough to do. I think especially the parents in this movie are kind of like, here are some good actors, and then they don't have anything to do. Will Forte and Lisa Kudrow specifically. That's a little bit of a disappointment. That being said, this is really fun. I don't think it's great, but it's certainly very good.
The thing I like the most about it is definitely the two of them. The warmness is there. I like the fact that a lot of the supporting characters who are seen derisively, as you might usually see in a kind of teen comedy like this, everybody kind of turns out okay. Like, in a way that almost feels like maybe not entirely realistic, but good-hearted enough that you feel like you're down with them. I definitely agree with you when it comes to supporting characters. I feel like that actually is a little bit of a problem, because some of the supporting characters just kind of disappear for a while and then pop up and are suddenly important. And in a way that I don't know if it entirely works. I think some of them are funny. I feel like the Billy Lord plays this character named Gigi, who I think is funny, but maybe pops up a beat too often. I might say Jessica Williams is wonderful, but I kind of don't get her character at all in this movie. I feel like there's not a lot there, and she does a lot with it, but there's not too much to go. But honestly, when the movie stops and just lets Amy and Molly hang out with one another, it more than makes it worthwhile with everything else that's going on. They are, not only do they have that thing where they definitely understand each other and have jokes that the other one don't have. There is a legitimate, like, deep, like, obvious, like, love, really, that they have for each other that I think comes across really, really well. Caitlin Dever, you weren't a Justified watcher. Did you watch Justified?
I was not a Justified watcher.
Justified is really good, and she was really great on it. She was about, like, obviously the show came out a long time ago. She's like a 10 or 11 on the show, and she was instantly, you saw her, and you're like, oh, this girl's going to be a huge star someday. She was obviously, like, she leapt off the screen on a show that's got some pretty great actors in it. She was instantly fantastic, and she was a supporting character in that show who would disappear for kind of like threads at the time. But every time he came back, she did the show kind of like stopped to a halt. So I was very excited to see her just as awesome in this. I will say, Beanie Feldstein, I know that she's getting a lot for being Jonah Hill's sister. Jonah Hill is very, very funny. I would argue that I actually might kind of like her performance as an actor and as someone that has to carry off some kind of tough stuff in this, I would argue she might be farther along than Jonah Hill was at this point in his career. I think Jonah Hill's turned out to be, actually have some dramatic chops. There's moments in this thing that she kind of carries by herself really well. I think one of the best scenes in the movie involves, inevitably, because when you have two people that are this close of friends, this is coming, the fight happens. And I think Olivia Wilde handles it in a really interesting way, and in a way that's both warm-hearted, that gets to the hint of the fight, but doesn't turn it cartoonish, and actually gets to, like, not only the truth of the fight, but also how the details don't really matter, and it's all going to be fine because they love each other, I think is really, really good. The movie ends with this great... on a very high, which I think is always a good thing in a movie like this. I wanted to bring this up because Beanie Feldstein is on the TV version of What We Do in the Shadows. Now, we talked about What We Do in the Shadows. Have you watched the show at all, Grayson?
I have watched the first two episodes, and she hadn't shown up yet. Yeah. I knew she was coming on the show. But yeah, I've
she's extremely funny on that show. That show is... actually great. I actually have been kind of blown away how much I love that show. I'm going to give a shout out, by the way, to Kaven Novak, who we talked about in Three Lions way long time ago. He plays Nandor the Relentless in What We Do in the Shadows, and literally every single thing he does makes me fall on the floor.
Did you say Three Lions or Four Lions?
Four Lions.
Yeah.
He was hilarious in Four Lions, and he is absolutely wonderful in this movie, in that show. But I just want to bring it up because Beanie Feldstein is really, really good on that show, and good in the same way that she's good here, in that, frankly, in a way that's better than Jonah Hill was at this age. And Jonah Hill was very funny, but there was always a little shtick to him a little bit. I think he's refined that, and he's been nominated for two Oscars. I think he's a good actor, but I think she's actually a little farther along at the same age that he is. There's a lot she has to carry here, and I think she does a really, really great job of it. I don't think a lot of the... I don't think a lot of the supporting characters... I don't think really any of the adult characters are very good, which is a little bit of a problem. Like, you'd like to have the Tina Fey in Mean Girls role at some point in this, and they're really... isn't anyone, unfortunately. And I don't think any of the adults work. But I have to say, there were times watching, even when I thought some of the supporting teenage characters were a little maybe not great, I found myself thinking of, like, movies like Can't Hardly Wait. That if I would have seen Can't Hardly Wait, I think when I did see it when it came out, I was like, this thing is fine. This is good. This is a movie that's got some good cheer. It's not great, but it's fine. But I guarantee you 15 years from now, when all the teenagers that saw this movie, they're going to adore this movie. I kind of feel that way about Booksmart. This feels like a movie that, like, 15 years, all, like, teenagers that watch this movie now will look back and, like, love all of those supporting characters, maybe in a way a little bit more than I do now. So I don't think it's great, but I think it's really good.
Yeah, in terms of, if people haven't seen Booksmart yet, you know, and of course, Beanie Feldstein was also in Lady Bird. That was kind of, in terms of movies, I think that was sort of like their first big thing. And of course, she was on Broadway. She was in Hello, Dolly. I mean, she's a big theater person. That's kind of her background. She's kind of hit in a couple movies now, which is great. And sort of interesting, the two of them, she and her brother, Jonah Hill, get along very well. And doing some research for a piece I was writing, I actually read their interviews together, and they're very kind of sweet. But she, I think, is very much a... she's very much a theater geek, as she would herself would sort of describe. And I think that brings a different kind of performance than maybe a Jonah Hill. And I think it works in this. They're really fun. And the fight scene that you're sort of talking about, I think for me, I like that scene, but it still feels like, and now the moment that this is going to happen is going to happen. And I feel like, especially in, like, maybe the last 40 minutes or so, there's a lot of, well, now we have to do this kind of scene. And as much as I like the fact that, as opposed to being like two loser guys, is these two outcast young women, there's a part of me also wish that the actual structure and the actual format and the way of thinking about this kind of movie was more radical. I feel like it's more conventional than I would have liked. That being said, you know, it's definitely promising for Olivia Wilde. It shows what she can do, because for someone who's also made music videos, I think that Olivia Wilde does a really good job with music in this movie without making it feel like a bunch of music videos. I think the movie does do a good job of getting a sense of that time in a person's life where childhood is going away, adulthood is sort of beckoning. I think it kind of captures that spirit really nicely. I say it's a little too conventional for my taste in certain ways, but again, when they're together, just watching trailers to kind of refresh my memory before we came on here to record this, just when they're just talking to each other, it's really, really funny. So yeah.
Yeah, I know that they spent, one of the things that the, again, reading the press notes about this is that they actually lived together for like 10 weeks to for this. And you can tell, like there is a clear, I don't know, maybe this movie's not going to be a big enough hit to where we get to see them together again in something else, but I feel like they're going back to the Jonah Hill thing, the Jonah Hill Michael Cera thing, where like I would watch these two movie people in an entirely different movie doing entirely different things together again. I'd like to see that here as well. They really do have a nice chemistry together.
Yes, and by the way, to bring it back to Short-Term 12, as we also often do, Caitlin Dever was also in Short-Term 12, so another person from that movie who's gone on to do great things.
Mm-hmm. Along with Will Leach Show veteran Stephanie Beatrice. Don't forget Will Leach Show veteran Stephanie Beatrice. I mentioned that Stephanie Beatrice.
Who among us is not a Will Leach Show veteran?
Not lots of people. It's an exclusive group.
It's an exclusive group.
All right, Grierson, what did you give it?
I give it a B.
I am also in B. I almost got to B+ for me, and I suspect if I were maybe a little bit younger, it probably would. Okay, maybe a lot bit younger.
Yes, but I don't want to do this, but I think the hype out of South by Southwest was a little too high. People were like they lost their minds over this. They thought it was like really like the next great comedy, and South by Southwest has launched those movies. It launched Bridesmaids, for example. I don't know if it's quite to that level. And I'm kind of a high B myself, but I just couldn't get to a B+ for this one.
All right, so that was Booksmart. Now we go to our reboot movie this week. Our reboot movie this week is Mad Max.
Tomorrow, in a world gone mad, the only law will be a renegade squad of suicidal cops.
He's my prisoner, and he's not walking out that door.
And the open road will be controlled by gangs of glory roaders. Max is a cop, one of the best.
Where does they're out to get you? Scoot jockeys? Yeah, nomad trash. Well, I'll add it to my thread collection.
Mad Max came out in 1979, directed by George Miller, of course, who would go on to make several Mad Max movies, including just Mad Max Fury Road, not that long ago. I found it fascinating kind of researching this movie a little bit, that I knew that George Miller was a medical doctor, that's kind of been part of his bio, but one of the things that inspired him to make this movie in the first place was taking care of people who had been in car accidents. So I was like, yeah, and there are times you watch this movie, you're like, that's a man that speaks of experience right there. That man knows what he's doing with car accidents. This, of course, stars Mel Gibson as Max, the eponymous Max. Though I have to admit, I did not know this, that he has a last name. His name is...
He has a last name.
He has a last name. Max Rockatansky, I believe is that's correct. Perhaps not an accident was not commonly used in some of the later movies. He's a cop in a... I appreciate this movie saying this movie doesn't start with in the not too distant future. It just simply says a few years from now, which I think is probably the right way to do it. But this is a movie where Max is a cop. He's in Australia, but in this world, I think we're starting to go veer toward the world of the later Mad Max movies where everything is falling apart and basically the where we're going to be in 15 years. And again, maybe I'm being too optimistic. But Mel Gibson plays Max. He is a cop. He is married. He has a son. He has a happy life. But he also is obsessed with not only like being a cop, but like driving. And this is a movie like some of the later Mad Max movies where so much of the action sequences involve driving. And this had a lower budget than some of the other ones. I would argue this movie generally makes good use of that budget because basically there are in this world that's slowly kind of starting to collapse. There are hooligans. I like the term hooligans. We saw some malfeasance.
I prefer street toughs.
Street toughs. Urchin living under the street. Street toughs. I prefer street toughs as well, actually.
Street toughs is pretty. I would say Susan and I will often use street toughs for things. It makes us laugh every single damn time. But anyway, yeah, go ahead.
Street toughs. There's definitely a lot of street toughs. They're all on motorcycles. They're all angry and they're all kind of doing a lot of horrible things to people on the roads. And so basically, Max is trying to capture them. And then he decides once his friend, who I don't want to give anything away, but again, as someone that had not seen this movie, it's amazing to me that there are two movies within the span of 7 years that are huge parts of cinematic culture involving a best friend character named Goose who dies. It's kind of weird. I don't know if that was an homage or what that was, but I was like, wow, I didn't realize that.
Can you imagine the number of journalists in like 1986 who are like, if we can just get one more.
Anyway, so basically, Max has to go. Something happens that Max becomes, that makes him very mad. And therefore, we have kind of the big closing sequence. I like all the Mad Max movies. I'd seen them all except for this one. And I still think Fury Road is the best one because it feels like the thing he was kind of always building toward. But there is an inventiveness to all of these movies. And to see it in the first one here, to see the kind of, I think I've used this term to describe things before, the hell's a poppin' nature of this movie. There's a certain madness to this film, from some of the scenes to the way that Miller kind of, in a way that reminded me of early Peter Jackson, will do before someone is about to crash into something that explodes, will do an extreme close-up of their eyes bulging out of their head.
I have to cross this off my notes now. You took my thing. Go ahead.
Pretty wild. I kind of love that little sequence. I feel like I'll let you talk about Mel Gibson if you want to get to him, but like I feel like the later Mad Max movies are better than this, but clearly that kind of manic energy and that kind of wild inventiveness was pretty much here from the start. And, you know, I will say I found myself a lot of times, and maybe this movie's 1979, where I'm like, man, you would think that just the way their society is set up, they would recognize the importance of seatbelts. Just there's no seatbelts in any of these cars. And if there were ever a time in history where you needed seatbelts, it is now. You need seatbelts at this particular time in history. I like the fact that there's a scene where something horrible happens to two people, but the movie seems to almost, right before that happens, it shows people destroying their vehicle in like gruesome, like detailed fashion in a way that's like, well, nothing after this could possibly be worse than what you just saw. The movie never feels dark. It always feels kind of crazy in a way when it sometimes loses some of the humanity of it all. But generally speaking, this thing was pretty fun. I was glad I saw it.
I had never seen this either. And it's probably my least favorite of the bunch.
I would say that.
I mean, what's funny is that it's just like the first half an hour, you're like, well, this is crazy, but it's not crazy, crazy. Like it's actually surprisingly sedate in comparison to what would come afterwards. There are car chases and the stuff that you expect from a Mad Max movie, but it's actually much more procedural and cop movie-ish in certain ways, in a way that was surprising. I wasn't expecting it. I have to tell you this. I saw this right before Cannes got going while I was in France. And you can stream this on Netflix there, but not in the States, apparently. But the thing, the reason I'm pointing this out is at the beginning of this movie, it says a few years from now. I saw a movie a day later in the festival that opened with a few years from now, and I was dying to know if they were in some ways inspired or if it's just a pure random chance. It was a Brazilian film. This movie is, it was weird because this is like George Miller's sort of like feature debut. I actually thought about another Australian, Peter Weir, who made this. His first film was called The Cars That Ate Paris, which is not set in Paris. It's set in Australia, but it's a small town in Australia called Paris. And that movie is also completely nuts, and it's about cars and people who are obsessed with cars, and things happen with the cars in that movie as well. There is something that feels unhinged in a way that is not unsatisfying while watching this, where it's, you know, for so long, this whole like snide joke about, oh, you know, Australia was, you know, like a prison colony and blah, blah, blah. But there is something that seems like the lunatics have taken over the asylum in terms of the making of this movie. And I'm so glad, Will, that you brought up the eyeball thing, because the benefit of watching this on Netflix streaming is I could pause it and rewind it 10 seconds and just to like look frame by frame at the at the bulging eyeballs. Like, what is that? Is that an effect? Because it doesn't look like a real eyeball at certain points in it. This movie has a screw loose. It's completely crazy. And it's not, it is, what's the expression? It's not, it's mental, but not in the way that future Mad Max movies are. I mean, I think I haven't seen Road Warrior in a while. I remember really loving that movie, so I don't know where that would fall for me now. So you actually kind of get to see Mel Gibson more as a dramatic actor in this movie than you do in the subsequent two movies, where it's much more kind of like action packed in that way. And, you know, we talk about this a lot when we talk about when we do these reboots and we go back and look at actors kind of at the beginning of their career. He is magnetic. There's no question about that. I don't think you look at him in this movie and say, oh, that's a superstar, because it's not a performance in which there's a real range of things that he does. I mean, basically, he is unhappy with these street toughs and he wants to stop them. And then something terrible happens like 2/3 of the way through. And then he's really unhappy with them. And then
he's really mad. He's really mad.
If you've seen that guy, he earns the nickname. Rocktanasky? How do you say his last name? What is
it? It doesn't matter. Max. That's how you say his last name.
Yeah, it's like this in another version of this movie, he becomes like a superstar, and they say, there's one thing though, Max, you gotta change your last name. It'll never work. So it's not a performance where you see the full range of whatever. I mean, he would do Gallipoli a few years later with Peter Weir, and that's more of a full-bodied sort of dramatic performance. But he embodies a type in this movie, and that's fine for what's required. I think for me, my big takeaway from watching it was that it felt, as crazy as it is, it actually felt more conventional than I was sort of expecting. I was sort of surprised. I don't know why they don't have seatbelts. The whole world of this like post-apocalyptic like universe is a little confusing. It's sort of like, well, you know, it's sandy. Okay, it's like this. It's like, and stuff is kind of falling apart. Like the, what is it called, the Hall of Justice or wherever it is that they work. Like some of the letters have fallen off, so you can tell things are fucked up. Apparently, because it's the future. Like that, the world is not sort of brilliantly conceived. I mean, I know it's well established that you like Fury Road more than I do. I like it. You worship at the altar of it, which is fine because a lot of people do. But the thing that Fury Road gets absolutely right is it creates the sense of a world. It creates a universe where you're like, holy shit. And much of the pleasure of Fury Road is just how that world is conceived. This one's a little spottier. This one very much feels like we've got $8 to make a movie. Let's just have fun. And I don't know how much of it was kind of done on the fly. Obviously, the action sequences, you can't do that with. There was also a part of me while watching this that thought, I wonder if the people who made Knight Rider took inspiration from the bad guy in this thing. Because they say Knight Rider like 800 times in this movie. And so I kept thinking, Knight Rider, that's kind of a cool name for a TV show. So yeah, I think that for me, it was nice to kind of fill in this gap in terms of my film education. I wouldn't say it was revelatory in terms of watching this movie, but it was fun to kind of go, oh, so this is where the whole damn thing started.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of Dead Alive, actually, the Peter Jackson movie, which I think is crazier than this, but it definitely has that kind of wild, out of control energy that I think you're kind of looking for. It's funny you talk about the world building. There were definitely several times where I found myself wanting to go to characters and be like, you know, there's an apocalypse. Like, you're in a post-apocalyptic hellscape. Like, you should know this. This is not a time to laze at the beach. This is not.
I was also kind of thinking, like, you know, you might want to. I mean, in the road, both the book and the movie, nobody's like, you know, kicking back.
Yeah, there's no relaxing time.
Yeah, I mean, there's not even like proper sentence structure in that book, for crying out loud, because everything's so terrible and bleak. Second straight Cormac McCarthy reference in a podcast episode. We did it. I will say this. I was actually sort of appreciative that the inciting incident, shall we say, of why Max becomes mad is not done in a gruesome, manipulative way. I was actually sort of wary that it was going to be kind of cringy. It is, I don't think it is in this movie, but it is funny to think that that is the thing that's then used to explain why Max is the way that he is. And I also kind of wish I'd seen this on the big screen. I would be kind of, also, I think like an audience, I think helps. I think an audience sort of helps create the sense of like, holy shit, the thing is fucking crazy. I think you kind of need an audience. I was just watching it by myself. It's not quite the same experience.
Yeah, so it's fun. It did make me want to watch, actually, all three. I may be kind of curious to watch all. There's got to be some sort of film festival where you watch all four of these in a row and watch the world kind of. That feels like.
And then you go mad. I will say, though, not to cross promote us too much, I feel like the Sci-Fi Network is playing Mad Max Fury Road a bunch recently. I feel like when I'm flipping through the channels, Fury Road does pop up a decent amount.
All right, so that's our show. That's Mad Max. Good stuff. I like the Mad Max movie. But yeah, you're Fury Road. Pretty, pretty, pretty awesome. All right, Grierson, so that's our show. Welcome back from Cannes.
Thank you.
We have three movies next week, Grierson, so prepare thyself accordingly. The first of the new movies is Godzilla, King of the Monsters. Directed by Michael...
King of the Monsters or King of Monsters?
It says King of the Monsters on the Wikipedia page. And so I think Wikipedia does a pretty good job, actually. So yeah. Give him a break. This is the guy that directed Krampus. Never saw Krampus.
Krampus is okay, but, you know, they're not leaning. Warner Brothers is not leaning.
The fact he's the Krampus guy?
Yeah, because it's like a horror comedy.
Yeah.
So with a pretty funny Adam Scott in it. But yeah, it's not an obvious segue in a film career to go from Krampus to the King of the Monsters.
But this one stars Kyle Chandler, Vera Farmiga, Bradley Whitford, Sarah Hawkins. Hey, O'Shea Jackson Jr. I wonder if he turns out to be a Republican. David Strathairn.
So Sally Hawkins is in this one?
Sally Hawkins is in this.
She survived the first one. She's apparently back for the second.
Apparently. Yes. Apparently. So Thomas Middleditch is in this as well. So Godzilla King of the Monsters. I actually don't remember very much about the first Godzilla. I remember Bryan Cranston being in it and then disappearing from it. And that's kind of all I remember.
I remember Juliette Binoche dying in an awesome way in that movie, and just the Aaron Taylor Johnson's in it.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, it was mostly for the for Godzilla and the
right. And this one appears to have other monsters that he is the king of, apparently.
is the whole thing like an election of some sort where they determine which of them is the king?
Yeah. It's like, that sounds very exciting. That's like the NFL draft equivalent.
it's the episode 2 Star Wars movie of, yes. Who among us shall be the king of the monsters? We'll find out.
We'll find out. Okay. So, that is Godzilla King of the Monsters. Our second new movie of the week is Rocket Man. Rocket Man is directed by what is this? Dexter Fletcher, who is the guy
Fletcher,
that,
yes.
who actually apparently finished Bohemian Rhapsody. So we know that he is able to complete successful movies about their biopics of major music stars without, you know, being an asshole.
and he directed Eddie the Eagle.
With the
star of Rocketman. So they have they've worked together before.
Yes, starring Taron Egerton. Taron Egerton is playing Elton John, which is funny because wasn't he just in the Elton John movie that Elton John showed up in Kingsman? They're in that together, right?
Oh, yes. Thank you for reminding me about that movie I didn't like. Yes, yes. That's correct.
Elton John is like the funniest part of that movie, as a matter of fact.
It's a low bar, but you are he is legit. I had forgotten that. I had forgotten that. Yes.
So,
have you seen this movie yet, by the way?
I've not seen this yet. So, Taron Egerton is playing Elton John. Rocket Man also stars Jamie Bell, Richard Madden, Bryce Dallas Howard, and I hope not Mike Myers.
I'm not going to say anything.
I'm so mad at you. I have to say, this is going to be a referendum. The deep cut for people that are staying listening to the end and are ready for next week's show. I'm still, if you remember, when we did Bohemian Rhapsody, I was actively mad at you for liking that movie. And I still am. And I still am because that movie sucks. And this movie better be better. This movie better be better. That's all I'm saying.
I'm not responsible for that.
I swear to freaking God, Grierson, if this movie's better and you like it less than Bohemian Rhapsody, and you do that sometimes, and it drives me crazy, then we're going to have a scuffle.
Oh, man.
Didn't you like... I'm trying to think of the last time that happened. Feels like that's happened a couple times. Anyway.
I feel like between this week and next week's episode, you will remember which these offenses that I have.
I want to say like Speed 2, maybe? I don't know. Maybe not Speed 2.
I never saw Speed 2, so it's not that.
It's not that. But that sort of thing where it's like the second one is obviously worse than the first one, but Grierson likes it, but dislikes the first one that everybody likes, except that the opposite. I don't know. I don't know what you think of this movie. I ain't seen it. It could suck. Who knows? Anyway.
We will find out.
We will.
I'm not going to say anything.
We'll get the chance. Okay. So, and then we have a reboot. We also may, if I get a chance, I'm going to see Ma, which is a Blumhouse horror movie. If we get a chance, we'll see that. I don't know if we're going to be able to fit in. This is a busy week and there's lots of travel and Grierson just got back from Cannes. So, maybe we will, but if we don't, it's okay because we have a reboot. And the reboot this week is 1978's National Lampoon's Animal House, directed by John Landis, starring John Belushi, Tim Matheson, Tom Hulce, Donald Sutherland. Remember Donald Sutherland being pantsless, if memory serves me correctly, in this movie. It's Animal House. I don't know if I've ever actually sat down and been like, I am focusing all of my attention and energy to watch this movie. I feel like I could recite tons of scenes from heart, but I don't know if I actually said them like, okay, I'm now going to watch this as a full-on movie.
It's been a long time since I've seen it from beginning to end, and not shockingly, I think it was college was the last time I saw this movie.
Sounds about right.
And,
I hear it's inspired some posters.
Yeah, we did Mad Max from 79. We're going back a year at a time. Yes. And now we're doing nice. Animal House.
Yeah,
yeah I because we have Godzilla King of the Monsters and Rocket Man, it seemed like a fun like college comedy with like the perfect complement to those other two.
To those other two movies. Yeah, this one also has Juliette Binoche dying in awesome fashion, right?
But a nuclear reactor factors into that movie and Animal House. Yes, that is correct.
Hi, Grierson. Welcome back. This show went a little long, but I'm glad it did because we had a lot of stuff to get into. Everyone go to your timgrierson.blogspot.com and you can actually see his ranking of all the Cannes movies, some of which we'll be discussing. You'll know better than me because I'm not going to see because I want to wait until some of these movies come out. All right, Grierson, welcome back. Hopefully, now that you're back in America, the Cardinals will be good again.
God, I hope so. They're not because I left. I mean, they didn't know I was gone.
Mike Schilt has started bunting like crazy. It's really weird.
Well, bunting is their team's not expecting that.
Yeah, apparently not. all right, Grierson. Next week we'll talk about Godzilla, Rocket Man, and Animals. Have a good week. Talk to you next week.
Bye.
Ball.
This shouldn't work, but it does. It only works 'cause of us. And should anyone say different, it wouldn't matter at all. This only works 'cause of